I'm your host, Mr. James, and you are listening to Right in the Schoolies. Over 10 years ago, I met this man when I was working as an English teacher in South Korea. We were on the same orientation program, and it meant that we were all sort of lumped together completely randomly based on which city we were going to end up in. I happened to sit next to him in one of our many, many tedious classes we had to do, and I was immediately struck by what a top bloke he was. Very friendly, very chatty, and always had time to nip out for an illicit drink or two before curfew. We then became really good friends for the next couple of years in Daejeon, and since then, I'm lucky enough to say that he's come to visit me in England. I've now been to see him in the States, and I even had the honour of officiating his wedding back in 2018. It was a good gig. My next guest is the brilliant, humble, and bloody interesting guy, Professor Euclid Ossie. So, Euclid, tell me a little bit about where you went to school and what year was it and what do you remember?
Yeah, so first of all, thanks, Joe, for having me in the podcast. And yeah, let me tell you a little bit about where I'm from and where I went to school. So I am from New York, from a Long Island, a small town called Huntington. And I went to Trinity Regional School for elementary and for middle school. So yes, I went to the same exact school from first to eighth grade. And then I went to St. Anthony's High School. And then I went to Siena College. So all of them were private schools. So I went to private school my entire schooling life.
And what was that like? I would imagine it was a slightly religious Catholic at St. Anthony's.
It was deeply religious. Yes. So Trinity Regional School was a quintessential Catholic school. We had nuns. I suppose not all my teachers, but a lot of the teachers were nuns. So they definitely preached discipline. They preached how we have to follow in the footsteps of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. and St. Anthony's High School was also religious, but it was of the Franciscan order. So we had Franciscan friars as our teacher, and our principal actually was a friar as well. And my university was also Franciscan, but it was a little bit less religious compared to my high school and elementary middle school.
And do you remember anything about any sort of uniform that you had to wear throughout this experience? You weren't made to wear a habit or anything, were you?
Kind of wish I did. That would have looked pretty cool, actually. That would have been some good drip. But no, we didn't have a habit. We just had a normal school uniform. And let me describe the uniform that I had at Trinity Regional. So I'm not sure if you're familiar with the TV show Family Matters. That was a popular TV show in the 90s in America with Steve Urkel. He was the nerd.
Oh, yes, Urkel. Sorry. I'm now remembering this.
So if you watch any episode of Family Matters, Steve Urkel will be wearing a red sweater with kind of two stripes, I believe on his left arm, if I remember correctly. We had the exact same sweater. So when I'd walk around my neighborhood, all the other kids went to public school. I was the only kid that went to Trinity Regional. And yeah, sometimes I hear some snickers like, yo, look at this dude wearing the Steve Urkel sweater. I'll just take it, like, whatever. So that's what we wore in elementary, middle. And then high school was just like kind of a really sharp looking blazer, not too different from what students will wear in the UK.
I think that's always the interesting division there between American schools and British schools, is that British schools, everybody wears a uniform of some nature. And it is typically, I remember when you came to the UK, we went around my first school as an NQT, and you were just walking around going, wow, these kids look so smart. And of course, you know, I'm used to seeing them wearing a shirt and tie. The girls are wearing ties as well, you know, and you're just like, this is amazing. They're wearing blazers. What? Whereas, of course, in the States, like you say, in the public school system, everybody wears presumably just their own clothes.
That's right.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Now, obviously, this is where I've noticed that we have some real differences in our school systems, both in the US and in the UK. And that is that in the US, it's pretty normal to have a school mascot of some kind or some sort of school song Do you want to talk about that?
My elementary and middle school, which was Trinity Regional School, was one of the few schools that did not have a school song.
Okay.
Nor did it have a school mascot.
Okay. So
in elementary and middle school, we had none of that sort. In high school was the first time that I had a school with a mascot, and our mascot was just a friar riding a horse. So as a member of the soccer team, there's nothing more discouraging than trying to be hyped for a game, trying to really put yourself in the right mindset to be, you know, an absolutely elite athlete. And then you just see some short kid on a horse with wearing a Franciscan habit, trying to pump up the crowd. I'm like, yo, this is not it. Like, the other schools would be like bulldogs. They would be like lions, tigers. And then we're like, 1, 2, 3, go Friars. I'm like, yo, this is not it.
That sounds horrendous.
It was really bad.
And obviously something that's very alien to British listeners is this idea of pep rallies. So I'm assuming that you'd be doing the Go Friars thing at those as well, right?
Yes, actually, at the pep rally is when we chose who would be the student on the horse for the upcoming sports season. So the person who was chosen to be the friar on the horse was the shortest person in the school. So at the pep rally, the teachers would try to identify, okay, who is the shortest person? And then they got singled out, put in the middle of the court. They were put on the horse, and then they were dubbed the friar for the upcoming sports season. So I felt kind of bad for that kid. He just wanted to, usually they want to keep a low profile because, you know, maybe they feel a little subconscious.
A low profile. Well, as the shortest kid in the school, that probably wasn't too difficult, I'd have thought. Can I just check as well? Is this a real horse?
So the horse...
Or was it a couple of kids dressed as a pantomime horse? This gets weirder.
I'm trying to not laugh for a second. So didn't clarify what the horse was. So the horse... Okay, sorry for a second. You can edit it out. I'm just getting back to memory.
I think this is glorious. I wasn't expecting this.
So yeah, the shortest person in the school was the friar. Yep. And then the two tallest dudes were the horse.
You're joking.
No, for real, bro. I'm not. So poor kid. Not only did he get singled out for being the shortest, but he had to find his way to climb the two tallest dudes on this horse. Oh my god! Wow. Honestly, thinking about that is so funny, man.
Was it the ugliest kid in the school that got made to be the back end of the horse?
Well, we never know. It wouldn't make sense, yeah.
So yeah, this because at least a real horse would have added some level of prestige to the whole thing. But yeah, I suddenly had this image of where are you going to find a horse in the middle of New York? That didn't really work as an image for me.
I think the arts department was responsible for making the horse for the year.
Right.
I remember one year specifically, the horse looks like something maybe Salvador Dali would have painted. I'm like, bro, why is one eye up, one eye down, the mouth? I'm like, dude, what is going on here, man? So yeah, the quality of the horse also evolved each year.
Maybe it didn't quite evolve in a linear fashion. It sounded like it went back and forth. That's amazing. This is why I love these questions, because every now and again you get some gold like this. Right. Let's move on to subjects. Obviously, in our world of education, we've specialized in a particular area. And obviously, as a historian, which is your first love, as I recall, you presumably would have enjoyed that at school. Tell us a bit about the subjects that you enjoyed when you got to high school and ones that maybe you weren't so sure of.
So yeah, you know me really well, Joe. I was always in love with history, just the stories, the incredible people, you know, the icons that we learn about. I remember specifically what unit got me into history was learning about the Civil Rights era, learning about, you know, as an African-American, learning about these brave people like Rosa Parks and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, and just realizing that these people are the reason why I'm in the position I am today. So I just remember, I want to learn more about this. Learning about history gives me so much like pride in my culture, pride in myself. So yeah, history definitely was number one. Number two it kind of wavered between science and English. My first dream job when I was a kid was to be a scientist, because I love that TV show, Bill Nye the Science Guy. I don't know if you've ever seen that before. I used to watch it every Saturday morning. So I fell in love with science first. And then as I got older, I started to like reading a bit more. So I gravitated towards English. And then I really fell in love with English my senior year of high school, because we started to read some authors like playwrights like Tennessee Williams and some African-American authors. So, yeah, basically history and English, and then a little bit of science when I was younger.
Help me out here. I'm imagining, and I'm very much just projecting here, and it's all conjecture, that this school environment where you're learning about historical figures, especially African-American figures, but you're learning probably in what I would imagine is quite a white school. How was that?
School was maybe between, probably 95% white. I was one of the few kids of color, one of the few black kids in my school. So yeah, learning about history was fun in class. When we got to, you know, the slavery unit and the civil rights movement, sometimes it would cause a few people to sort of, you know, feel uncomfortable in their chairs. And I just remember, God bless him, he was my sophomore year history teacher. And I can tell he meant the right thing. He didn't mean to be offensive at all. So he was talking about, slavery and the slave trade and, you know, the long lasting effect that it had on the course of, you know, American history. And then he asked me the question, so like Euclid, like what do African Americans think about slavery? And I was just like, loaded. Like in my head, I'm like, what does every single person in my race think about slavery? I'm like, and then everyone turned around and I was just like in the spotlight. And I'm a very, at that time, an extremely, extremely shy student. So I was just like deer in the headlights. I was like, yeah, it's pretty bad. I can't remember what I said. I just remember being put on the spot out of nowhere, pretty uncomfortable.
It's really tough, isn't it? Because you can imagine that teacher was trying to do the right thing and trying to address some sort of wrong with it. But it's amazing how wrong-headed people can be. Mm-hmm. And of course, this is still going on. I'm not sure if there's as much of a debate in the USA, though. I'd imagine there definitely is. There's a big debate at the moment in the UK about how we teach history and how we teach things like colonialism and the British Empire. And a lot of people believe that we don't do anywhere near enough on things like colonial atrocities and actually looking at that. And yet we'll spend, you know, a very long time, rightly so, talking about the Holocaust. And it's this idea of, are we not maybe being a little bit imbalanced in how we teach things? And also, you know, some people get the wrong end of the stick and go, you know, things like literature saying, well, we need to be teaching with more, you know, authors who are black and minority ethnic rather than a bunch of old dead white dudes. And it's a debate, and an interesting debate as well, because there's one side that can say, it is very important because representation is very important. You know, people need to grow up seeing that it doesn't matter where you're from, that you can achieve. And here is an example of that. And other people say it should be done on which stuff is really good and interesting. And of course, I think that the biggest problem in all of this is time on the curriculum. There's never enough time, as we know, as teachers, to cover everything.
Yeah. I think right now we're in a really big transitional period when it comes to history curricula in America. I mean, I'm not sure if you've been seeing some of the articles regarding like critical race theory. They want to include that as one of the subjects taught in public schools in some states in America. And there is a really big debate about that, whether or not we should teach students that there are differences in the way that certain races have been treated in America, or should we just kind of, you know, gloss over that and just move forward as a society. We don't need to really focus on the atrocities. So there's, right now is a transitional period and we don't really know exactly what the right, solution is at the moment. But what's important is that we're having open and honest dialogues. And once we open up the dialogue, at some point, we're going to converge and we're going to figure out the best way to move forward. So right now, it's slightly uncomfortable, and that's a good thing. Mm. I think it's great. We have to be uncomfortable before we reach the next step in a more equitable society.
And it is one of those things that I find very telling, actually, about who are the people criticizing the idea of studying these things in more detail. Quite often you'll find that they fit a certain demographic of people that believe that they're being threatened by it, or people that, again, I feel get the wrong end of the stick and go, why should I feel guilty for that? It wasn't me. And you go, that isn't actually what anyone's trying to do. And if you feel guilt for it, right, fine. You know, I mean, God, I feel a level of guilt for most things, even things that weren't actually my fault. But you can feel a collective sense of, well, that was out of order. That shouldn't have happened. And certainly, obviously, you live and work in Korea. You need only go back a couple of hundred years, you know, in some cases, maybe not even that far, to find things like the Korean comfort women, you know, that reparations for that have been very, very slow to be done by the Japanese government, but now they are. And there are some people that say, oh, gloss over it and move on. You go, but some of those people are still alive. You know, you got to ask yourself, there are descendants of people who need to know that it's recognized that that was wrong and that we won't do it again.
Yeah, it's impossible to move on if there's no reconciliation, right? So absolutely, we need to first come together and just reconcile the wrongs. We don't need to, you know, we don't have to focus on them forever, but we need to have open and honest dialogues, and we need to navigate this trauma together as a society. And once we do that, then we can move forward to a better future. So I think the example you gave with Korea and Japan is really apt for that as well.
You mentioned the subjects that you really enjoyed. Which subjects did you find just difficult, or for some reason or another, you weren't engaged with?
Yeah, you know what? It's kind of ironic, as my name is Euclid, the father of geometry, and my father is a mathematician. His major was in math education, master's degree in pure mathematics, applied mathematics, and a second master's degree. So when he, you know, when he had me, he had high hopes that I would become, you know, the next big thing in math. And it was by far my worst subject. It was by far the subject I hated the most. And it's because I didn't see the purpose of why I need to learn trigonometry, why I need to learn the quadratic equation, why I need to learn about all these things that I couldn't see at that time of any value in. I couldn't understand the value in English. I could understand the value in literature, specifically in history and science, but in math, I would just disengage, and I'll definitely keep my Game Boy close to me and keep it under the desk and play some Mario or Pokemon or something like that. For sure.
And do you remember anything about the way that you were taught in terms of I can imagine, and this is a stereotype about the kind of school that you went to, but it seems to be one that has been perpetuated. Schools that are quite sort of dogmatic tend to do a very didactic style of teaching. Certainly, you know, this is how we learn it. This is what you must do. There is no room for creativity or lateral thinking or making it more interesting. Would that be fair, or have I got that wrong?
Imagine a Franciscan friar teaching you pre-calculus. And that pretty much will summarize how the classroom experience was. It was very dogmatic. It was just like trying to show you a formula and then give you example until you sort of get a good idea of what it is and move on to the next one. And then there's no discussion. There's no room for asking questions. There was, even after class, if you stayed and say, hey, like brother, blah, 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 I didn't understand today's lesson. It's like, okay, well, you need to just like look at your notes. I mean, I can't tell you anything else. And so, yeah, I felt like I was kind of abandoned in that class. I feel a lot of students felt abandoned in that school when it came to math, because the teachers were of not the best quality, unfortunately, compared to the other subjects. They were taught a certain way to teach the subject, and they never evolved.
Very interesting indeed to think that was, you know, we're the same age. You know, we'd have been the same school year. And while there were certain things from my early time at school that I remember looking back now and thinking, oh, you probably wouldn't do that now, some things are still valid today. But I think that when you've got people who are in positions of power in a religious organization, are they hired based on the power of that rather than the style of their actual pedagogy and their well, not only that, but their willingness to teach children? Because teaching kids is about patience and understanding sometimes, even when it really annoys you that you feel you've explained it really well. If a kid doesn't get it, you might not have explained it as well as you think. But it sounds like there wasn't room for debate on that at all.
Yeah, if it seems like the teacher doesn't really care if you get it or not, then you just sort of disengage and you stop trying. Because like if the teacher doesn't care about your progress, then why should you? And I remember like I learned that now I'm the teacher myself. I always make sure to answer any question my students have, any concern they may have, any difficulty they may have, in as much detail as I can. And I want to make sure that even after my explanation, if they don't understand, I want them to know that I value their progress so much. Like that's the focal point of the school, is to make sure that they progress in academics. So even if they have difficulty, I want to show my students all the time that I care about them, their academic performance, and also their lives as well. In a way, I guess that experience helped me as a teacher.
Yeah. And we'll certainly touch on some of that later on, I think. But now, obviously, keen sportsman. And as long as I've known you, you've always been one of those rare Americans that enjoys the game of soccer.
Isn't it called football?
depends who you ask, really. But given, you know, we were talking earlier on about basketball and, you know, things that I would consider to be more traditional for someone growing up, you know, on the outskirts of New York City. What drew you to that? Was it something at school that you were able to go along to, or was it very much a later on approach?
I was always big into athletics, specifically soccer, because my parents are from Haiti. And in Haiti, soccer is not a sport. Soccer is a religion. It's a passion. It's everything. So one of my first memories, just memories in general, is the 1990 World Cup. I remember I was three and a half years old. I remember all my uncles, all my cousins. I'm like, yo, why are all these people watching this random thing on TV? But I remember how excited they looked. I remember they're kicking around this ball. I'm like, man, this is the best thing ever. Like all the people I love are here. They're enjoying, they're singing. So I think from an early age, I just love the sport. So I played, the first time I joined a team, I was 8 years old. I tried to be a striker and I was fast and athletic and I couldn't hit the target at all for any shots. My coach said, why don't you play goalkeeper instead? Because you're athletic, you can run, but you have no accuracy, but maybe just dive for the ball and maybe that'll help you out. So that's how I became a goalkeeper, fell in love with the sport. And I played for my high school team. We were actually league champions and we were actually ranked nationally in the United States. We're one of the top 25 teams in the whole country. And we were the best team in New York City. We were a really good team. And some of the players on my team became professional soccer players.
Wow. Yeah. And it was one of those big differences between football / soccer in the US and over here, of course, is that it's that difference between most of the US soccer team, men and women, are college educated because they normally have to have gone to college to have played at that level a lot of the time. Whereas, of course, over here, your average UK footballer, you could argue, hasn't been to university. And because a lot of the pathways are done so much younger, people join an academy very early on, and that's how they learn their trade through that. And there's a pyramid, obviously, of people who don't make it, which is obviously so much higher. I guess it's a bit like with the NFL where, you know, you get people who technically they go to college, but they're often picked as, you know, sports scholars. Were there any other extracurricular activities that you tried to get involved in, but maybe weren't for you? Any good stories on that front?
let me think back. Hold on. So let's see. In high school. So I remember, I was basically, I wasn't part of any particular group. Let me kind of go back, right? So I wasn't really part of any like stereotypical group. I wasn't part of the jocks. I wasn't part of the nerds. I wasn't like part of the cool kids. I was just like, I did my own kind of thing. I was like cool with everybody in my school. So with that in mind, some of the activities I did were just like pretty random. So I was part of the the Glee Club.
I've stitched you up here, Yuke. I knew about the Glee Club. You know how I know? Because your mates told me about it at your wedding.
Oh, really? Okay.
I was crying with laughter because you weren't there. I remember going, you're having me on. Yeah, you got sold down the river there, mate.
Yeah, no surprise. I'll take that. Yeah, I was part of the Glee Club, and we had to. So all the songs we had to sing were Gregorian chants in Latin. So sometimes I would watch a movie, and there's like a song in the background. I'm like, yo, I know the song. I know all these random Latin songs because of Gregorian Glee Club. Probably the uncoolest thing you can hear is a Gregorian Glee Club. Like, if you want a verse on a first date, and you're like, yeah, I'm part of that Glee Club, like, it's a wrap.
I don't know if you've seen the news recently, but our wet lettuce of an education secretary has ignored all of the things that he should be doing, and has just said that he wants to level up schools by making Latin more of a focus on the curriculum. So maybe that's how we could do it.
But you know what it is like. That learning those Latin songs helped me with foreign languages.
I'll bet. Yeah,
it really did. So that's why I'm good at speaking Spanish and Italian, because their root is from Latin. Yeah. So that really did help me, actually. It really did.
There are always things to be taken and learnings to be taken from any experience. So I'm glad you were able to get something useful out of it. But it is quite amusing to imagine you. Did you have to dress up for it in particular?
For certain performances, we had to wear. Man, I'm getting some memories back. Maybe that they were repressed for a reason. But we had to wear kind of white habits for certain performances. If we had to go to another church to perform for like the senior mass or whatever, yeah, we'd have to dress
up. Did nobody do the most awful, unspeakable thing, but decide for a laugh to grab a couple of pillowcases while they did it, just to wind people up? That could have been. That could have been a moment.
Oh, man. I didn't even think about that.
I got this image of just thinking, fuck. it was the all-white thing. I thought, oh, maybe they might wear... Maybe you might wear some sort of, like, I don't know, gown, but not a bloody... Oh, wow.
Well, thankfully, the people in the Glee Club were pretty innocent-minded, so no one thought about that. But, man, nowadays, yeah, that would be pretty funny, man.
Dear. Now, moving on to some things which I know to be true. You're a very law-abiding citizen, and in the time I've known you, you don't tend to break any rules. You're an inspiration to many. However, I'm sure that you were more of a wayward youth at times than you'd like people to believe. So would you mind telling us about any times that you got into trouble, be it completely your fault, partially your fault, or you just happened to get caught?
I can remember two instances. One was in middle school and the other one was in high school. So in middle school, I mean, yeah, I can't say I was like bad. So, like, if I would get bored in class, I would like just do like naughty things. Like, I remember on a school bus, this is relevant since the Olympics are going on nowadays. I organized the bus Olympics.
Okay.
So what that was every day we have a different event. So one event would be, well, sorry, I need a second to, it's just funny to think that I actually did this. Like,
how old are you at this point?
I was an organizer. I would have been like 10 or 11 years old.
Okay.
I was always a really good organizer. Like, nowadays, you know, I'm a really organized person, but back then I used my organizational skills for malice. So the one of the events was, we start at the back of the bus and there'll be two teams, one on the right hand side of the bus, one on the left hand side, and then one student, which was me, clapped. You have to climb over all the seats as fast as you could, and then whoever touches the front of the bus first will get like the medal for that day. And then the day that I got in trouble was when I organized the under the seat challenge, where they had to like military crawl under the seat, and one student got his like lower back cut on, I think, the seat belt that was like hanging from a chair.
Shit.
So I got called to the principal's office and they told me it wasn't even, they weren't even mad. They're just what are you doing? You're clearly better than this. Just stop. And I was yeah, I'm sorry about that. Just stupid.
I imagine a worse place to be stuck than underneath a school bus seat with all the chewing gum and bloody wrappers on the floor. That must have been pretty grim for that kid.
Yeah, I felt bad because he was a little bit husky too. So I'm oh man, of course, kind of the bigger kid, he got kind of stuff. I felt so bad. Oh, really bad. In high school, I've just always been kind of a rule following student, law abiding kind of person, but I got detention only once in high school, just once. I got in trouble one time. So my good friend Mike, it was senior year. It was one of the last weeks of school. And I really just stopped caring about school. I was just getting ready to go to college and I already got accepted to my university. So the last few weeks were just a wash. So during lunch, my buddy Mike said, "Hey, do you want to just go to the deli and just get lunch? Let's just leave school." And that was a big no-no. That was a really big security risk in our schools. You can't leave campus during the school hours. But I was what are they going to do? Kick me out? I'm ready going to college. I don't really care, man. So we went out to the deli. We got some bagels. We got the typical New York bacon, egg, and cheese on a bagel. That's the New York sandwich. So we got that. We chilled there for 20 minutes. We came back to campus and, the security guard that was in the parking lot wasn't there. So I'm yo, we got up scot-free. I'm yo, we're lucky, man. And then my buddy just pulled out a cigarette. I'm yo, what are you doing, man? We're in the car. I'm dude, we got to go back to club. You got to go inside. I think we're kind of tempting fate now, bro. We got to stop this. Nah, man, who cares, man? Let me smoke a quick cigarette. So I'm all right, shit. So he's smoking, he lights up, puts the window down and the smoke is billowing out of the car. And then the dean of academics, I think he went outside probably to have a smoke himself behind a bush. I don't know how he was outside or why he was there, but he saw the smoke coming out of the car and he ran to the car and my friend didn't have time to throw the cigarette out. I was oh, come on, man, we got in trouble. Nah. And he was who was smoking? I'm not a snitch. My boy's not a snitch, so we just book took the rap and we both got detention. I was really mad because at my school you had character points. So if you start with 100 and for every infraction you get -5, -10. If you get below 70 character points, you get kicked out of the school. So that cost me 10 character points, and my parents got a letter saying Euclid has been deducted 10 character points and 20 more, he's kicked out. And they weren't too happy about that.
No, I can imagine not. Having met your parents, I can imagine that your mother would have would have told you in no uncertain terms what she thought of that type of behavior.
I heard about it, yeah. I heard.
Well, one thing that I remember you telling me a while ago was that you had to do confession as well at your school, and
there were some
great stories around how long people were in there for. Would you mind telling us a bit about that?
Yeah. So in middle school we had to do, I don't know if it was monthly or bi-monthly, confession. So we had to go to the chapel and there was a priest. He had the option of doing it face to face or behind some type of screen, but most kids are behind the screen because it was just funny, we can say funny things to the priest, whatever. So after you would say your confession, the priest would tell you, you're forgiven for your sins. Now you need to do X amount of Hail Marys and X amount of Our Fathers. So during confession, I'd be I'm sorry, I fought my sister. I called her a doo-doo head, something stupid, whatever. And the priest was all right, man, just go do five Hail Marys, you'll be good. So you go down to the pew, you go on your knees, you pray, and you sit up. So what was funny is we try to see who had who was praying the longest. And we're this dude has been praying for 30 minutes. What did he do? How many Hail Marys is this dude saying? What did he tell the priest? So we think about stories he definitely killed someone. we're making stories. gossip, bro, this dude definitely sells drugs. this dude knows where the body's at. So it was a pretty funny thing, seeing who's doing the longest prayer. Because they're bad as hell. What the fuck do you do?
Oh, that's very good. I like that as well. This idea that you're sort of coming up with theories, and it's always funnier when you're not allowed to laugh as well. I can imagine if you're sat sort of in the church trying not to chuckle, it must be pretty tough.
Oh wow! Sorry, I thought about something really quick about that. So one time, there was a guy I was praying, and he was praying for a really, really long time, and we're doing exactly what you said, thinking of theories, you know, like just doing the same old thing, like kind of laughing at him, like joking on him. And then we realized that, you know, he's been down for a long time, like for real, like a long ass time. So we started to get concerned, like, yo, did he like for real kill someone? Or like, he's been praying for like at least half an hour. So at one point, one of the students is like, yo, let me like see if he's okay. So we go to him and then like we shake him and he passed out. He was out cold, unconscious. I think like the church was too hot, and I'm like, oh, he was sweating. His shirt was covered in sweat. I'm like, oh, snap. So our teacher took him, just took his limp body and ran out of the church.
Maybe he found God. Who knows?
Yeah, he got converted. We were all dying. Like, yo, we thought he like killed someone, but he's like actually dead himself. Like, damn.
You were just thinking he was really getting into it. Like, he's just really, he's in the zone. Turns out he's just gone. Brilliant.
Yeah, that was funny, man.
Tell us a bit about your teachers, Uke. Were there any ones who you would say were actually really quite good and that you respected and you felt that you learned stuff from? And were there any that you just absolutely despised or thought nothing of?
You know, I always respected teachers for the effort that they gave in the classroom. As my father is a teacher, so I know like the amount of effort it takes into lesson planning and whatnot. So I never really, you know, despise a teacher, even if they weren't that good at teaching me. I just knew they're trying their best in their own way. Although I did have one teacher that changed my life forever. She was the best teacher I've ever had. She's the reason why I am a teacher and the reason why I am the person I am today. Her name was Miss Fabricatori. She was my 12th year, so my senior year English teacher. And up until that point in high school, I had a lot of stage fright. I was really self-conscious about the way I spoke because I used to have like a really bad stutter. So when I'd get nervous, I would just kind of stammer and not be able to speak. And I was in an advanced English class. Like, I was good at writing essays and good at test taking, but we had to do oral presentations about every book that we read.
Okay.
We had to go in front of the class and we had to have index cards and we had to like speak about our, you know, our analysis of whatever chapter we need to focus on. So I remember the first presentation I did, it was just an absolute disaster. People were like snickering at me. You know, it's like kind of tough, like being like the only like Black kid, also being like the only, like, I'm also shy. I just don't like to be like in the center of the attention. So like standing in front of like all of my peers, already feeling sort of like self-conscious, like about just talking. It was really nerve-wracking. Like, I'm pretty sure I had a panic attack.
Really?
If I look back at it. Yeah, it was really bad. So I remember like once I finished the presentation, I sat at my desk, like my head in my hands, just like wanting to just like dig the deepest hole in the ground and just hide forever. Like, really ashamed of myself. Like, everyone else is just a good job. And look at me just like stuttering, sweating. And I was like looking at the time, like, I can't wait until this class is over. I need to go home. Like, this is a disaster. And then once the bell rang, my teacher said, hey, you, can you stay after? And she was like, yeah. So didn't have the best presentation today. I'm like, yeah, I'm sorry. She said, no, don't be sorry. Like, you just need to work on it. So the first thing we're going to work on is your speaking speed. So you need to slow down. And if you slow down, you're not going to stutter. I was like, really? He's like, yeah. So why don't you come to my class during lunch and let's practice your speech. Let's practice you like speaking a little bit quieter, and I'll like time you. I'll give you like a thing to read. I have a timer and try to read this in X amount of time. So I'd go over to her class for like weeks on end just to practice speech. And that gave me so much confidence, not only just for giving presentations or just for myself. I'm like, wow, I can do hard things. Like, this is really hard. This is like my biggest insecurity, was talking in front of others. And I conquered it because this teacher. And then the rest of the semester, I was not only looking forward to the presentations, but I love them. I would read these books and take notes, and I would just go up there and like really like expose my soul to the class, like really share like what my thoughts were for about the novels that we read. And that changed me. That really changed me. Like I became more extroverted. I realized that no matter what challenge I have, like I can conquer it. If I can conquer stuttering, I can conquer anything. So I need to really thank her. I want to write her a letter. And now I'm talking about her right now.
Do we know if she's on social media? We could potentially tag her in this episode and she can hear it directly from you. So that's Miss, what was her name? Sorry.
Miss Fabricatori.
Fabricatori.
Yeah. So maybe I'll look for her. And if she's out there, I'd love to just tell her, like, really thank you for helping me out.
And if you're listening to this, Miss Fabricatori, I'd like to say thank you for making sure you now won't shut up about anything. He's he just chats.
Pandora's box.
But what you were saying is very true, I think. When you have a teacher that notices that something's not right and could quite easily go, I'm going to just call it a day there. It's a Thursday afternoon. I'm tired. I've got papers to mark, whatever, you know, but taking that 5 minutes and just saying, hey, don't be sorry about it. This isn't, I'm not reprimanding you, but I am saying to you, there are some simple fixes. And it's so, so easy to not allow that to happen. And also some students wouldn't necessarily want to be pulled up on it. They'd leave the classroom as quickly as they could. So it takes,
I tried to.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say that would have taken a lot of skill and a lot of empathy from her to have noticed. And very few people, I think, very few stutterers, and I was a childhood stutterer myself. Obviously, I've interviewed a few people are the same. And quite often it's because they've got a lot to say and they can't get it all out at once. So the speed, like you say, the speed of speech is the first thing. And it's nice when somebody can recognize a problem which for you feels insurmountable. But to them, they right. go, well, I've seen this before and it's quite conquerable if you do these things, if you work at it. And of course you will have gone away and done that.
Right.
Yeah. Well, good stuff. That's a cracking story. Now, Uke, this is obviously a purely audio podcast. People can't see us. But if they could, they'd see that you are, as ever, you bastard, a devilishly handsome young man. Were there any crushes or awkward situations when you were at school?
I had a lot of crushes, and I feel like some girls liked me, but I had absolutely, unequivocally zero game. I was the most unsmooth, awkward person in the world. And the one time I tried to actually approach one of my crushes, can't remember her name, but maybe I try to block it out of my memory. The only time I tried to approach one of my crushes and tell her that I liked her and I wanted to go to Little Vincent's. It's like a pizzeria. I want to go get a slice of Little Vincent's. I asked her, hey, like, do you want to go like get some pizza? Her response was, ew.
Oh, dear.
Talk about a confidence.
That'll set you back.
Set me back. And I was like, well, I tried. And that's what happens when you put yourself out there romantically. I was like, man, I was savage, man.
And how old were you at that point?
16.
Oof.
16. So that was like, you know.
That's rough.
The insecure age where like you're kind of growing into your sex. You're trying to own your sexy. And then cold water was thrown on that. Very, very. I became humble that day.
I think it happens to the best of us. It's one of those things. Brilliant. My final question, Uke, is just about more of a reflection. Feel free to take as long over this as you like. But if you could meet your 16-year-old self again, as you are now, knowing what you know and having experienced what you've experienced, what do you think that they'd want to hear, or what do you think they would need to hear from you?
So that's a really great question. Trying to think back to when I was 16 years old and who I was, where I was at that time. I remember being unsure about the future, being uncomfortable in my own skin for many ways, trying to find my identity. I will just tell my 16-year-old self that don't be afraid of challenges. Don't be afraid of change. Don't be afraid of failure. Don't be afraid of heartbreak, because every challenge that you're going to face from this point on is going to mold you into a man that you're going to be proud of. That's what I would say. So I'll say just embrace everything that comes at you, the good, but especially the bad, because failure is going to be your best teacher going forward, my friend.
And how do you think your 16-year-old self would have coped if you'd have said, by the way, by the time you get to my age, you'll have lived for over 10 years on the other side of the world, and you'll be doing this job, and you'll have met all these people along the way, and you know, you will have the title of professor. Do you think that they'd have gone, nah, no way?
My 16-year-old self wouldn't be able to comprehend that statement, because that would have just been so far from who I was at that time that it wouldn't even make sense. It just wouldn't make sense at all. I'm a different person in every facet from when I was a teenager. So if I said, yeah, you're going to be married to a great person, you're going to be living in South Korea, your job is going to be teaching, your job is going to be speaking in front of other people every single day. You're going to be learning different languages, living in a different cult. He wouldn't even know what to say.
No. Which I think just goes to show the scale of the challenge that you took on and how well you did with it. Tell us a bit about that. Tell us your journey and what you've learned about how South Korea's education system, very, very respected in the world sort of scales like PISA and stuff. But what's it like being on the ground?
You know, when you think about the Korean education system, you think about where it's ranked, you know, internationally, like number one in math, number one in science, number one in test scores, standardized test scores. They recently won the World Robotics Championship through KAIST University. It's a really, you know, when you take a look at it on paper, it really seems like, wow, what are they doing right? Because they seem to be ranked number one in everything. And it's good in some ways, because they really do emphasize excellence in academics and elementary, middle, high, and college. But what I think a lot of people don't see is the downside, because what is fueling all these successes academically is a hyper, absolutely ridiculously hyper competitive education culture, where there is like the ranking in your high school determines what college you can go to and what major you can have. And one incorrect answer on a test score can pretty much shape your future forever. So these students are staying up late studying. They're going to after school academies. They're going to cram schools, and they're not getting the chance to be children. They're not getting the chance to be creative, to have hobbies. Everything is scheduled for them. Everything is regimented. And right now, a lot of the students are unhappy. You know, a lot of my students expressed to me how unhappy they are, because, you know, they spend all their lives studying and they feel like they haven't had a chance to live. There, I think really, really soon there's going to be some type of revolution in the education system in this country to give the students just more time to breathe, more time to be children, more time to have to be kids.
It was certainly something that came through loud and clear when I interviewed Billy Kong. And obviously Korean Billy, yeah, no, he's younger than me and you, and obviously an incredibly successful and clever young man. But yeah, you know, he went to, I was getting the name wrong. It's one of the Sky universities. It's the Y, Yonsan? Yonsei. Sorry, I always get that wrong. Yeah, no, yeah. Obviously, he went to Yonsei University. Must have done incredibly well on his, the big test you have to do to get into university.
So that test is called Sunim, which is like the Korean version
of the SATs in the States, and our final year sixth form exams here. But yeah, he really, I think, in typical Korean understatement, glossed over a bit of just how competitive that really is. And he talked about drama and about how things like that, things like acting and whatever, you know, it's there, but it's not seen as anything that you might do seriously. And given, you know, it's this idea of we get we get in our heads about what will be useful for the future and what will sort of really, you know, be good. And I think the culture in Korea, from what I experienced, was all about trying to get ahead of that next person. It's almost like America in the sort of in the 1940s and 50s, that sort of trying to be the keeping up with the Joneses or keeping up with the Kims, you know, trying to be better than the people next to you, ultra competitive, which school they're going to and how they're going to achieve them, how much money they're going to make. And I don't know, it's very, very different.
Right. And, you know, one of the side effects of like the really high competitive education system is unfortunately the suicide rate of especially like young students is quite, it's the highest in the OECD. So has to be something that changes soon with that. You know, this is not, it's not sustainable. There's a lot of great things about the education system, but they need to just, you know, make it less competitive to let people be people.
And of course, the other thing that I remember really noticing a lot was just how it was the family pressure that seemed to be the driving force. And I wonder if the older generation, you know, the people who are, you know, the generation above us, for example, they maybe have a very different appreciation for what it takes to get ahead, because when they were growing up, Korea was quite a poor country. And do you think that it's possible for change to be effected in a country that's so steeped in tradition?
You know, there's always a breaking point. You know, you can be a country steeped in tradition, but when the truth is right in front of you, you have to confront it at some point. And the truth is that a lot of children are excelling academically and are also deeply unhappy at the same time. So that's just a fact. And they have a choice right now. They're at a crossroads, whether they can either confront that reality or just sweep it under the rug until it boils over, until it becomes insurmountable. So they have to confront it. And I think Korea has a track record of, you know, look at the way that they bounced back after the Korean War. You know, they are good at mobilizing and coming together and making the society better. So I have optimism for the future in Korea. I think they'll sort it out.
And hopefully in the future, one of your students will be saying similarly good things about yourself to what you were saying about your high school teacher. I think that that's probably the only way things will get better, is if we are passing on these good feelings of, you know, you should make room for your mental health. You should make room for mistakes, and anything else is unfortunately a hangover of an old regime, really, that's no longer as valid.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Yuk, as always, a pleasure. And if people want to find you and talk to you on social media, where can they find you? Would you rather that they didn't?
Yeah, if the people want to follow me, my only social media right now is Instagram. So feel free to follow me. It's at Yuk, that's EUC dot Osse, OSSE. And yeah, you can slide in my DMs and shoot me a message. Well, that sounded kind of weird. Hold on. Actually, don't slide in my DMs like that, because my wife would definitely not appreciate that. But if you have any questions, anything you heard in the podcast, feel free to message me.
And obviously, at some point in the near future, we hope to have you over here in the UK, and we can take you on some nice historic tours, a bit like we did a few years ago. That would be very nice indeed.
Can't wait.
If you wish to support the pod, you can find me on Twitter at SchooliesPod, or just search Right in the Schoolies. And that's the same for Instagram, Right in the Schoolies, under the name Mr. James. Your homework is, of course, as ever, to give me some lovely reviews and some nice feedback. If you know of anybody who you think would want to be on our pod, be they well-known or lesser well-known, but you think that they have some good stories to tell, then get in touch on my social media. Class dismissed.